So did you guys see my Instagram story?
No, I'm not on Instagram that much. What was it?
I got to be a firefighter yesterday.
Nice. Oh. Congratulations. Yeah. What did you do?
Did you make the calendar?
No. although with some of these pieces of art that Andrew has requested, there could be a calendar of them, an inappropriate one.
I am actually making We're Not Wrong merch. At some point, I've been collecting Yankee Doodle Panthers and Gin Briny Storm Goddess softcore porn that people send me.
I will eventually just make a spank bank of...
I plan to make a calendar featuring all of us. We need to come up with more stuff for
you.
I need more
caricaturable... Mm-hmm. You know, yeah, I don't know. Maybe something that's like a bomb thrower, shitster, some sort of gremlin, some kind of...
the journalism gremlin?
Yeah, yeah. Just something that really fucks everything up. That's kind of, I feel like, my aesthetic on the show is chief shitster.
Hey, Jen, you're welcome for me giving you Storm Goddess as your visual avatar. I get a panther in a suit.
Yeah. The Yankee Doodle Panther.
But he's cute. James, I don't think you want to be a shit stirrer, Justin. Like, those images are going to be really gnarly, as will gremlins. Like, if you're going to nickname yourself, do it better.
No, I feel like that fits, though. You know, Heaton is not human, but well-dressed.
Mm-hmm. That's true.
Jen has perfectly spherical tits and controls the weather. And I handle human feces for money. Like that, that I feel
that's
like,
actually the description of our show on iTunes.
Yeah. Well, as long as you're comfortable with it, I don't care. But yeah, so my best friend's a firefighter. So I went down to hang out at the firehouse and they got three calls. And they let me go with them. So I got to wear like the headphones and
cool.
It turns out when firefighters are driving places, they're pretty much just talking shit on people that they see and each other. And it's really funny. So I enjoyed that. And I also learned something because our first call was to a community garden where there was a fence on fire, but there was no one near the fence. And so some people had put it out, but it turned out that they had put down mulch next to the fence. Mm. And if you get mulch that hasn't sat long enough, there's some bacteria in it that can just set on fire in the sun. And so that's what happened.
Wow.
Basically, like spontaneously combusted.
Yeah, hay will do that.
Yeah, that's what I heard.
Hay bales are surprisingly flammable. If they get wet, it feeds this bacteria that heats up. So like if you get a lot of rain at a barn, sometimes you have to go out there and get these really thick leather gloves because it's so hot you can't touch it and rip the hay bales open to keep them from bursting into flame.
It's so insane. Like, I never would have thought that any of that's possible.
This is why I don't trust the outdoors. Like, this never happens with inorganic material. Everything should be
electrical
made.
Fires?
Yeah. Well, no. I mean, like, at least you know an electrical line is something that can catch on fire. There's a mythology around it. We are warned by it. You are lured into a false sense of security with nature.
Yeah.
You are to believe that mulch is inert. You're to believe that a hay bale will not light on fire. And the next thing you know, as if struck by Zeus himself, now all of a sudden you're dealing with calamity.
That's a good point. Like shag carpeting doesn't just burst into flame.
No.
Like,
no.
Yeah. Like, Afghans don't burst into flame. But yeah, hay bales and mulch.
Yeah, there was this guy that ran up to us and he was like, there was no one there. And then there was a fire. You know, I didn't understand what happened until the firefighters told me that it kind of happens all the time.
Jen, that's super cool. Did you sleep there?
No, the little bunks that they sleep in are kind of like tiny prisons. So
yeah. Did you get to go down the pole?
They didn't have a pole. It was a one-story.
What?
Fire. Yeah, it was a one-story.
Wait, did you
fire
say it
department.
Was a Montessori fire department? Like it was
no, a one-story.
One-story.
Oh, one-story. That makes far more sense. I would love to watch an SNL sketch about a Montessori fire department.
I think you found the fire department you join. If there were a Montessori fire department.
Oh, I think being a firefighter would be awesome. I did years ago, Jen, when I was working for Congress, I did a ride-along with a fire department in Washington, D.C. And it strikes me as one of the best communities in the world. Like you are, you're doing meaningful stuff, but you're doing meaningful stuff in between large pockets of just dicking around with your friends. You're just playing PlayStation and stuff. And
I walked
super
down
tight community.
The neighborhood that I'm at, there's a fire department on one side of the, Jen used to live on one street that bracketed my neighborhood. And then the other side, there's a fire department and it's just dudes,
yeah,
just rip dudes playing pickleball.
Yep. And they're,
that's
they're,
it.
Their yeah. wives are all friends with each other. Their families are really interconnected. Yeah, it's cool. I had a great time. I didn't know any of the firefighters, Jen, when I did it. So they let me stay there in one of those prison bunk beds. And they were like, yeah, if the alarm goes off, if you can get to the fire truck before we leave, you can come with us. And I went, okay. And I slept there not knowing that no one told anyone else that I was there. Like a whole shift had changed. So all the firefighters were different. So from their perspective, a bearded man in a trench coat just got into the back of the fire truck and was like, where are we going? What are we going to do? And they were really cool about it. They were like, all right, bearded man, we're going to a fire.
That's amazing. Yeah, it's basically a giant man cave. They had five recliners facing a big screen TV. Mm-hmm. And then one of the guys cooked an amazing meal. He took a couple hours to do it. And so, yeah, it's a lot of chilling. And then I kind of like this too. They store their pants on the side of the truck with their shoes in the pants. So it almost looks like it was the rapture and all the firefighters went to heaven. And there's just pants everywhere. So, yeah, just all this little stuff that you just, they're so prepared. And yeah, it was the best day. I had such a good time.
That's awesome. Way to go.
Yep. And that's how we celebrate Police Week. On the We're Not Wrong podcast.
Well, actually,
stories about the fire department.
If anybody has connections, doing the fire ride-along was super cool. I would love to do a police ride-along. I think that they're a little bit more antsy about that now, particularly with journalists than they used to be prior to BLM.
But. I don't know. I've, at least whenever I've talked about police stuff, I have gotten very earnest, you should ride along stuff. So
really?
Yeah. I mean, I think they want it more.
Oh,
now.
Okay, great. Yeah. If anybody in Austin knows anybody, I'm totally down. I'm game. That'd be fun.
Yeah. Well, geez, that ruins the joke I wanted to go out on.
Oh, sorry about that.
You just made it into an earnest plea to do a ride-along. I was hoping for a little fire department, police department rivalry. From Austin, Texas, I'm Justin Robert Young.
I'm Andrew Heaton.
And from Redondo Beach, I'm Jen Briney.
And we're not wrong. On this edition of the program, we're going to talk about the biggest wealth transfer in history, according to the New York Times, as well as the Durham Report, the long prophesized report into the Russia investigation into Donald Trump, what I can only compare to MAGA World's Snyder Cut, finally came out. And we are going to talk about all that as well as your emails. Back in the States, Jen, you have made it back to Southern California. How are you readjusting to Californian life?
I love it. In fact, I've decided I'm going to switch all my doctors from the Bay Area to down here just because I really love being here. And this is where I'd rather be tethered. Because I mean, you guys know better than anyone that I've been really into beach volleyball lately. And so
really?
I've been watching it in addition to playing it all the time. And so I've been going for my runs in Hermosa Beach here. And I'm just seeing all of my favorite prospective Olympians just practicing. I've seen pretty much all my favorite teams except for one in the last couple of days. And then I was walking on the beach yesterday and just ran into this guy. His name's Travis Merwerder, and he hosts the Sandcast, which is about pro beach volleyball. And I just like ran into him and met him, and it was just, it's amazing. And so it's inspiring to be around these people and to just see them every morning. So this is where I want to be. So I'm actively switching.
Do you want to do a quick Olympic beach volleyball breakdown here before we get into our political show? Do you want to branch out? Maybe a little backdoor pilot for the Jen Briney Olympic beach volleyball cast that we'll spin out on?
I think you should think bigger, Jen. I think that Joe should become a firefighter. You two should live at the fire station, play volleyball in the sand pit outside the fire station, and then just record a podcast in between.
I mean, that does sound like a pretty good life. I'm not against it.
Sounds financially lucrative.
Doesn't matter. You live at the fire station. They cover all your stuff.
In the little prison cells. Yeah, that sounds really nice.
Never lonely.
Yeah, I mean, it's really early in the Olympic running. And that's why I'm getting so into it now, because I'm really, they just started the qualifications in, I believe March was maybe the first tournament. So we're still so early, and like a lot is determined by the world championships, which doesn't happen for months. It's really like the end of this year, beginning of next year when the,
okay. Yeah. I was going to
do little segments for you.
Where are we at in the cycle? Because COVID totally fucked up my internal clock on knowing like when World Cups and Olympics and everything are, because everything got canceled and pushed. So
well,
when is the next summer
cycle
Olympics?
This time? So usually you have 4 years in between. Well, you only have 3 years in between. And so the Olympics are going to be next summer in Paris. And so that's what everyone is doing, the qualification. Ah.
Wait, they're only 3 years now. Do we do like a Westeros thing where the white doves came out? The summer's shorter or longer?
No, there was
like,
this thing called climate change. There was this thing called COVID.
Oh, okay.
Are you familiar?
Yeah. So we didn't do the Olympics during that.
Yeah, you guys watched April Ross win the gold with me. Remember? We were in Nashville.
We were in Nashville.
And we watched the gold medal match.
Oh, right. I do remember that.
That was our first recording together.
Mm-hmm.
We did a recording and then we watched on a hotel TV with no sound because we didn't have time to make it back to the bar.
Mm-hmm.
The gold medal game in Japan, right?
China.
No, it was Tokyo. You're racist.
I thought it was China.
Or I'm racist. Find out who's racist by the end of this show.
Let us know.
I'm almost positive it was Tokyo. Because Japan.
I really hope it's Seoul, South Korea, and you're both super racist.
Oh my God, the double racist. Double racist all the way.
I mean, I generally don't give a shit where they are because I'm not there. So it could be anywhere. I never watch the opening ceremonies. Like, I don't care. So that's, maybe I'm racist and I don't care.
Sure. You're very colorblind, both of you. Good job.
Yeah. Well, you certainly knew Paris. Wealth.
Well, because I wanted
to
go.
United States.
But I'm working with you guys next summer, so I can't go.
I mean, you know, look, how could you stay away? They're so legendarily friendly. Wealth in the United States has more than tripled since 1989, reaching $140 trillion by 2022. The vast majority of this wealth is projected to be transferred to the millennial cohort and Gen X heirs, largely facilitated by the growing popularity of giving while living from the baby boomers that currently hold it. This phenomenon is already having a significant effect on the broader economy, enabling social mobility for some while exacerbating obstacles for others due to the soaring cost of living, housing, and raising a family. The wealthiest 10% of households are expected to give and receive most of this wealth, with the top 1% dictating the largest share of the money flow. This wealth discrepancy is largely attributed to the uneven way the baby boomers have benefited from price growth in the financial and housing markets, with the average price of a U.S. house rising 500% and the stock market growing over 2,800% since 1983. That is 40 years ago, I know, because of my ticking clock of mortality. The wealth transfer is anticipated to impact various aspects of economic life, including housing, education, welfare, financial markets, labor markets, and politics. High net worth and ultra high net worth individuals, comprising only 1.5% of all households, are expected to inherit over $30 trillion by 2045, with prospective taxes on estates and transfers amounting to $4.2 trillion. This is made possible in part by the U.S. tax code, which allows individuals to transmit up to $12.9 million to heirs without federal estate tax. Despite this, there are many who worry about their financial future, such as low-wage earners and the sandwich generation, who face the dual burden of caring for aging parents and children simultaneously. As the wealth transfer proceeds, it is expected to draw inequality further into focus on policy debates, with some arguing for a bigger welfare state and others advocating for innovative ways to raise the baseline standard of living. This was a big New York Times investigation. It profiled a bunch of people, but it was brought to my attention by one Andrew Heaton. So I ask you, does this oncoming transfer of wealth need to be dealt with through public policy?
Yes, I think so, because I think a significant amount of this transfer of wealth is already happening through public policy. I liked this piece. I like that the New York Times is, in this instance, getting people to think about inequality along generational terms as opposed to some sort of illusion that we live in a caste system. A lot of the inequality that we have in the United States is, in fact, a generational gap. And it's good to think of it that way, as opposed to thinking of like people that are in a low-wage job permanently occupying that job, people that are in the top quintile permanently occupying the quintile. The economy is fluid. We change over the course of our lives. But in terms of the inequality that exists at that generational level, I think there's good inequality and bad inequality. I'm 39, you're 40, Justin and Jim?
Yeah. Considering the fact that I know exactly how long ago 1983 is, yes, indeed. Okay. I am 40 years old.
We'll just say we're all 40. If you're 70 years old and you work your whole life and you save a little bit of money, you should have considerably more money than the three of us at age 70 right now. There should be more money in your account than we have. That's fine. And there's nothing wrong with that. If you've been accumulating money and compound interest and so on and so forth, good on you. That's terrific. The bad kind of inequality is when the wealth is not coming from work you've done or from some value you've created or from the compound interest you enjoy on that. The bad inequality comes when you're actively taking it from somebody else. And in terms of intergenerational terms, when you're taking it from younger people. And I think younger people have every reason to be pissed off. I think people younger than me definitely do. The transfer of wealth that's been happening over the last 30, 40 years is arguably the largest transfer of wealth in American history, if not human history. And you're kind of holding the bag if you're on the younger end of this. So we've got, on the one hand, depreciating dollar for my entire life. So like if you started working in 1980, a dollar was worth about $3.14 now, maybe higher because we've been having inflation the last couple of years. But that is to say that the dollar's lost 2/3 of its value since 1980. When you deflate the economy, or excuse me, when you inflate the economy, when you devalue the dollar, you make labor worth less. The people that are affected up front are labor. When you're young, all you have is labor. You don't have assets. You can work. You can go do hours for that. When you have an inflationary economy, then the value of the work you're putting in is less. But at the same time, people want to put their wealth in something that is safer than cash and safer than just holding money in a bank account. So they put it in assets, which are what old people own. So the inflationary economy that we have intentionally had the last however long is actively taking money away from workers, young workers, and giving it to old people that own stuff. It's an artificial construct that shifts the wealth from work to old people owning things. On top of that, what's the main thing people own? We've talked about this a lot on the show. Justin, what's the main vehicle of wealth accumulation that people own?
My house.
Justin's house is the correct answer. The bulk of American wealth accumulation is
the linchpin of the American economy. Mm-hmm. My house in Austin, Texas, in South Austin.
We've spent the last 40 years turning that into the singular vehicle for wealth transfer and wealth accumulation in the country, and we've rigged the game. We've made it so that we've created massive artificial scarcity. For an unrelated project, I was looking at this last night. Most major cities in the United States, about 75% of the real estate land, not all the land, but just the land for residential housing, is by law single family dwelling units. You can't build duplexes, triplexes, apartment complexes. We've intentionally restricted the amount of housing that jacks up the housing supply. So it's great if you bought a house in the 1980s because there was less demand and now it's gone up. So that increases that value. But if you're younger, it's harder for you to buy a house. So you're getting screwed over on that. And then on top of that, I think looking at Social Security, there's a large amount of deficit spending that the current generation and the prior generation are going to get to enjoy that we're going to be left holding the bag on. And in particular, people that are born now are holding the bag on. So at the moment, if nothing changes with Social Security, the fund taps out, I think, in 2033, which point it'll be like a 20%.
Now, that is a thing for which I have heard my entire life, mm-hmm. that Social Security is going to tap out, not to make it another thing that everybody's going to warn about, but doesn't seem to have, we keep warning about the iceberg, but yet we have not hit it. So mm-hmm. why are we so sure that it is going to tap out in 2033?
So the way the Social Security Trust Fund is set up is Social Security has to be paid out of the trust fund or out of surplus. It can't go out of the deficit, which means that when we tap the surplus, when we're no longer running the trust fund, the trust fund's been tapped dry, We can only pay Social Security out under current law based on tax revenue. Just looking at kind of basic projections, when we implemented Social Security, I think the amount of workers to people getting a payout was like 1 to 62 or something like that. In about 10 years, it's going to be 2.5 people for every one worker. So the base of the pyramid's been shrinking considerably over the last few years, plus people are living longer. As a result, there's really no way around either our generation is going to have to pay higher taxes or get benefits later or get lower benefits.
You saying that, though, you're like oh, okay, well, it has to be paid for this and this. It can't be paid from the deficit. My initial instinct is like, oh, they're just going to switch it so we can pay from the deficit. Let's go to Jen because we haven't heard from her yet.
Well, the actual policy suggestion that's being kicked around about Social Security is making wealthy people pay the same percentage that everybody else does. Because if you have a pay, and I don't know the numbers right now, there's actually a hearing that happened fairly recently that I'm going to watch that examined these very questions. So I don't have these answers right now, but I do know that we pay into Social Security up to a certain amount in our paychecks and then it cuts off. And so there's very, very wealthy people that are not paying into it. And if we just made them pay, you know, the same percentage as us poors do, then we'd actually have a lot more money in the system. So there are different ways.
You're correct. The reason we don't do that, I think it's 150, it's either 125,000 or 150,000 that's subject to payroll taxes for Social Security. The reason that we do that theoretically is because you're paying back a percentage of your top income over the course of your life. So if we were to raise that floor and say, well, you're now going to do payroll taxes up to $1 million, that would mean that the Social Security payout for those people would be much, much, much higher. So it would also change the outflow.
That's also a choice. We don't have to give them as much back as they put in. Like if you're benefiting.
Right. And I think that that's a way to shore it up. A way to shore it up is just, you know, have a higher tax on wealthy people to put it in. I would point to Social Security more as an emblem of the kind of deficit spending that's happening all over, where a significant amount of consumption is happening right now that's being financed by IOUs later. And that's probably going to come in the form of depressed wages or higher interest for us, but in particular for kids that are born today. So I think that there are policies right now that are transferring wealth actively from workers to the wealthy owners and from unborn people and people just entering the economy to fund the stuff that's enjoyed at the moment.
Jen, do you believe that this needs to be dealt with through public policy? And if so, what should it be?
Well, I feel like we're talking about something different than the article that I read this morning in the New York Times, because the article was talking about a transfer of wealth coming from people who have money who are then giving that money to their kids. So it's a transfer of wealth from the boomers to the millennials and the young, but it's like familial wealth that's getting passed down. That's the transfer that they were talking about.
Yes.
And one of the things that I noted, I mean, Andrew, you said that housing is like the main way that wealth gets transferred. So it's like you inherit a house. But there was another stat in there that was the stock market. Like there's a lot of money that gets, first of all, this massive transfer of wealth that went to the baby boomers. I mean, the stock market went up like 22,800% or something crazy.
Yes.
I think was the stat. I didn't write it down, but it was a lot. So it's like the stock market and us basing our economy around the stock market has really benefited this generation. And one of the things I found really interesting in that article was talking about how they are transferring that wealth to keep the wealth in their family via stock market vehicles because they don't get taxed on that. So it's like when you do transfer a home or real property, which is the way that most of, you know, us, you know, middle class people get wealth from our parents, there's taxes involved in that. But if you do it in a way that you have never actually cashed out a stock, you're just giving it to your heirs, that might not be taxed for generations. And so that's one of the ways that we're keeping generational wealth. And another graph that I found amazing was the amount of wealth that particularly white people have. And so I think having this wealth transfer happen within families is a way to keep white people way overrepresented in the realms of the wealthy. So what I was reading there was, you know, a way that elite families get to stay elite families. And so when the question was posed, do we need to do something about this? I think probably, and I think probably what it needs to be is taxing them. Like what I have witnessed in the 10 years of Congressional Dish is, you know, elite people, rich people, a lot of whom made their money in the stock market, have paid for lawmakers to change the tax system so that they get taxed a lot less proportionally to the rest of us. And I think that needs to change. And I think that's the only way you're going to tackle this type of inequality, because what I'm witnessing with this, it's not even like, I think even calling it a transfer of wealth was kind of weird, because it wasn't it's a transfer within families. So it was a way of keeping wealth in families. I didn't like the use of transfer, because it's not really transferring to anyone. It's going from the dad to the kids, you know? What we're witnessing right now are rich families staying rich. And if we really want to value people's work, like one of the things happening in the debt ceiling debate right now is work qualifications. They want that for poor people to get welfare. How about some work qualifications in order to get massive transfers of wealth from your parents or from their stocks or from work that you did not do to earn insane wealth? I think we allow rich kids to stay rich and pass on that wealth from generation to generation in this country. And while I do think there is some merit to, if you earned it, you should be able to give some of it to your kids, I do think there is an argument to be made that those kids have to contribute to society to get that. And we don't have any requirement like that right now. And I think that article is really what that's what it nailed home or for me.
I think that's definitely the most popular response is take the money away from people that have a lot before it gets to their kids, to sort of try
or
to-
Or in the process.
In the process. A couple of things. I left out the stock market because that doesn't bother me. The stock market's a proxy for the growing American economy. And so if the stock market increases by a whole lot and you can buy into it, and I think 20% of stocks are owned by pensions, which are a middle-class vehicle. That to me seems like a very easy way for people to get involved in the economy. So that doesn't really bother me. If you're making your money because the stock market's going up, that just means the economy's going up.
Not necessarily. Because if you think about what the stock market does, is it's transferring wealth from workers to owners. Because the workers, like, you're a labor cost. So they're trying to keep your paychecks down. They're trying to limit your benefits. And then the savings gets passed on to the owners via the stock market. Like, that is a way to shift wealth from workers to the owners in our society. It is a class system. And so when you look at the people that benefit the most, it's these wealthy families who are not necessarily working for that money, but are betting on these companies and being rewarded based on all these cuts that are keeping people poor.
If the stock market does poorly, it benefits the workers?
No, that's not what I'm saying. But I am saying that the stock market doing so wildly well during our lifetime is indicative of more of our health costs being having to be paid by workers out of pocket. It's indicative of us paying ever increasing rent, which means that that's going to the corporations that are then passing out the benefits of that to the owners via the stock market. Like, the stock market is the method of transfer of wealth from our pockets to sometimes our own. Like, if you own stock, like, sometimes it does come full circle, but I think it's the people that own the majority of the stock that have benefited from this, because we are paying a lot more out of pocket, especially compared to other countries, for services that used to be paid for by taxes. You know, when our wages don't grow at the same rate as productivity, that difference is going to profits, and those profits go to the owners via dividends in the stock market. Like, that's the transfer of wealth. And that's what the baby boomers have benefited from. And so I think we also have to look at, like, at the end of that article, they said, like, you know, the question isn't what's making these people rich. And I don't necessarily think we have to penalize them, but the question is, why are the poor people poor? And it's very, very hard to move up in this country right now. And I think a lot of that is because our labor has been progressively devalued, and we have to pay so much more out of pocket. And when we're padding profits like that out of our own pockets, we have to keep in mind that a raising stock market doesn't benefit all people, because those profits come from somewhere. And a lot of times it's our own pockets.
So your thought would be the way to do that would be to more intensely regulate labor relations, how corporations operate, and expand the social safety net. And then that would probably rebalance that proportion.
I mean, I don't like the phrase social safety net all that much. I feel like we should be getting higher returns on our tax investments. So, yeah, like, compared to other countries, like, childcare in this country is non-existent. Our healthcare system, as we've discussed many times, is an absolute disaster and is so expensive for us. And I was talking to the firefighters about it yesterday, and you know, the private ambulances and the way that we bankrupt people with medical bankruptcies. Mm-hmm. You know, this is the stuff that affects the lower end of the income scale. So what I would like is for our tax investments to go less to things like war and tax breaks for the rich, and to go to things like healthcare and childcare and just like making the basics easier to do, so that people who are working have more time to work and have more time to be creative and aren't so exhausted all the time and don't have to work three fast food jobs in order to pay their rent, which is ever increasing, which again goes to these corporate landlords, gets funneled, you know, to the stock market. Like, there's a lot of people that are suffering for that.
Where I would be happy to meet you halfway, Jen, I don't really have a problem with redistribution. I think you're going to have redistribution in a liberal economy. My problem is with command economy tactics of attempting to make the economy do particular things rather than just taking profit and redistributing it. So if you were going to, like, say, raise taxes and have subsidized childcare or paid childcare or something, but as part of that deal, we like drastically reduced zoning and we got rid of occupational licenses, I would take that deal.
I think there's like deals like that that could be made with good faith people that wanted to make it work.
Like if you were to really prune back the regulatory state and we had higher taxes but lower regulatory state, I would take that deal.
I mean, that's a place to start. That's a place to start. But I do think when we look at transfer of wealth, we can't ignore the stock market, because that's a huge part of it.
Well, yeah, I guess that's my only thing, is that I feel like we're kind of talking past each other. And it's funny, there's an email a little bit later that I think will be very interesting after this conversation. But like the stock market, from what Heaton is saying, is that it is an indication that the economy as a whole, not the relationship with the workers, but the economy itself, is growing. And there's no doubt that that is the case. Now, whether or not that is something that is equitable to labor, whether or not labor is better off in this country between, you know, 1940 and now is I think another conversation in terms of the relationship between the economy and the workers. But regardless of that, if we are to look at the stock market as just the heartbeat of how much money is coming through America and whether or not investment via the stock market makes that bigger, I think it's a fairly open and shut case that it has, right?
I don't.
You don't? Why?
Because a lot of the companies that we're talking about in the stock market are multinationals. It's not money that's coming through America. It's coming through these stateless, enormous companies. And so, yeah, you can place your chips on them, and it's probably wise to do so. But to say that these are American companies is ridiculous. Like, it's an indicator of some part of the economy doing well. But if the consequence is that workers are getting poorer and sicker and not being able to be
again, I want to separate that the relationship between the economy and the workers, because I do think that there is a whole nother litany of what I'm just procedurally, just so we can understand, and we're all talking about the same thing.
Okay, so even with that, though, the point I want to make is looking at the stock market as a measure of the American economy is no longer accurate because of these multinationals. Those are not American companies. And they're a part of the stock market.
They do not employ Americans or service Americans.
Some Americans, but they also employ and service people from all over the world. So it's not indicative of how our specific country is doing. It's much bigger than that.
Yeah, sure. I think proportionally, like some proportion, you might not say, yes, every company that is traded on the New York Stock Exchange fully benefits Americans, but
yeah, I'm not bothered by the multinational thing. Like, so for example, like Toyota sells cars in the United States. They employ workers in the United States to build those cars. Americans buy the cars. You can purchase stock in Toyota from the Japanese stock exchange. There might be an American affiliate here. I'm not really bothered by the multinational element. I would also draw a distinction between stock prices and dividends. I think you make a fair point, Jen, that there's a relationship between dividends and reinvestment in the company. And that reinvestment could be in terms of higher wages for employees or better benefits and things like that. But just the stock prices themselves, I think, are just how much is the company worth. So it's just a good proxy of what the overall GDP is.
I mean, it's how much the company is worth, sort of, because it's really, it's how much do people believe in the company, because it's how many people are buying the stock, which is why we have people like dicking with the stock price. It doesn't necessarily mean that that's what the company is worth. I mean, we've seen so many overvaluations of shitty companies because it's, it's so much of it is based on faith and betting.
I don't know of another way that we would more accurately realize the value of the company, though. You would just have the government like say what a company's worth. There'd be like a registry of value.
I mean, the difference between revenue and expenses seems to work most of the time with other companies. I don't see. I'm just saying that like the stock market being the barometer of our economy, I think it's an inaccurate barometer and we should stop using it as such.
I think that part of the loggerheads that is coming here is I don't know if anybody is saying that the entire economy should be based around the stock market. And that is something for which you believe. And I don't know if either of us necessarily agree that, that the economy should be based on that. However, I think what Heaton is saying, and correct me if I'm wrong, is that it is a pulse of the economy on some level, even if like, what you said,
a pulse, but it's not like the pulse, not
well, like, I guess it would be hard to say when the S&P goes up
2 points, I don't go, damn it, workers got screwed because the stock market's growing. But how about, I want to take a break from this for a minute because I do think that there's an interesting conversation to be had about inheritance tax. So can we move on to that?
Yes, we can.
Great. I'm not necessarily opposed to inheritance tax. As Justin noted, I think after 12 million inheritance taxes kick in, there's a philosophical argument to be made that you've already paid the taxes, so you shouldn't be double taxed on it. But something that I was playing around with is I like the idea of what was called the baby bond. I think Cory Booker floated this during his ill-fitted presidential campaign. Hillary Clinton had kind of a similar thing of basically just everybody gets some amount of money when they turn 18, sort of like an 18-year-old UBI type thing that you'd probably take off the top. I like that idea because being a equal opportunity type guy as opposed to an equal outcome type guy, I think that there's a good argument to be made that everybody should have some level of
purchase. Wait, hold on. The government is just going to give a lump sum of money to 18-year-olds?
Something like that, yeah.
Oh, I'm investing in septum piercings and back tattoos. Right? Hello, new fortune.
Well, but so that's all kind of secondary. The thing I was thinking of is the thing we're worried about, like intergenerational wealth accumulation, is that like what we're trying to solve for is making sure that there's not money that's stuck in a family?
I just think that if you want to look at inequality, you have to look at generational wealth being passed down without any kind of distribution back into society. And I think you're right about double taxation. So it's like in housing, if you bought a house, you did pay taxes on that, and then you pass that to your kids, that would be a double taxation situation. With stocks, not so much, because a lot of them are not taxed, especially if you're using something like an IRA you never touched. To have something that was never taxed to begin with, to then go on to the next generation where they might not touch it, and then it goes on to the next generation. So it could be something that, you know, a index fund or whatever that was bought for $5,000 that all of a sudden is worth millions of dollars that was never taxed from generation to generation. And they're straight up saying to us that this is one of the vehicles that they use. I think that's one of the things we have to look at is like, are there methods that these wealthy families are using where they never get taxed to begin with that we could look at? But again, like I think the final sentence.
So you're it's not so much that you would increase an inheritance tax. You would just try to close up the step up loophole.
I mean, again, like I'm not all that focused on taking stuff from the rich. I'm more focused on why are the poor's poor? Why is it so impossible for people that don't have this generational wealth to accumulate it and get to the point that they can also pass stuff down to their heirs? Like what is happening at the bottom that has left that dark blue line on the graph so low for so long while the people that have a lot continue to go up? Like that's the problem we have to solve. I'm looking at the bottom more than I'm looking at the top. So I'm not all that focused on taxing the rich. I'm more focused on making life easier for the people at the bottom so that they can move up as well.
And that's fantastic. I have the exact same perspective, Jen. I am concerned about the floor. I'm concerned about poverty. I'm not really worried about inequality. I'm worried about poverty. And I'm more concerned about helping people at the bottom than punishing people at the top. I think we're in the same position on that. Couple of things just to kind of give everybody listening, Justin and Jen and all the listeners, kind of like a big picture of the interlocking spheres that we're looking at. Intergenerational wealth doesn't tend to accumulate more than a generation. Usually the people that make it to the top 30 list or whatever, about half of their wealth is gone by the following generation. And it's completely gone within three generations. So the current mechanism of just making sure there is no accumulation of wealth kind of happens naturally anyway, because people piss it away. In fact, I think, and this is, Jen is not purporting to try to hike up inheritance taxes, but a lot of people that would like to do that, I think it might actually end up weirdly locking in generational wealth, because right now I can just give my kid, if I'm a billionaire, I can give my kids money and they're going to piss it away. And then their grandkids are going to go to improv classes and it'll be gone within three generations. But if you put a really high inheritance tax rate, I suspect what billionaires would do is create trusts or create foundations to lock that money in a tax dodge that could be accessed by their family in perpetuity. When we get to the bottom side, which I think is the real crucial point, and I'm glad that Jen draws attention to that, I do want to bring up the generational thing real quick, because we tend to talk about the lowest quintile in American economics as if it is the same people, and it is not. To kind of illustrate this for people, let's say that the average height of kindergartners this year is 3 feet tall. And 10 years from now, the average height of kindergartners is 10 feet tall. The way we talk about economics most of the time in the country, people would go, that's terrible. Those kindergartners are still 3 feet tall. They haven't grown. That's awful. But when we're talking about the proportions of the American economy, like the lowest quintile, we're not talking about a caste. We're talking about people that are at a particular phase in life, and they do move up over the course of their life. You're going to have more money when you're older than when you're younger. And there's lots of things that exacerbate that kind of image in terms of inequality stats. Like, we measure inequality based on household. We don't measure inequality based on individuals. So Justin and Ashley and I all have the exact same income, according to inequality, Justin's household is far more inequally distributed than me.
Hell yeah.
Then you add in some age stuff, like a 25-year-old who is not married is not in a joint household, so they're not getting those two income streams, and they're earning the lowest amount of money they're going to have in their entire life, far lower than somebody that's 50 or 60. So when we're talking about lower quintiles and things like that, I think talking about absolute poverty or people going bankrupt because of medical debt, things like that, that's very relevant, right? But when we're just talking about inequality in terms of wages have not risen, we're talking about flashpoints. We're not talking about a set of people. Just like, again, kindergartners are not the same kindergartners from year to year.
But as you're saying this, I can't help but think of that graph that showed that by far the wealthiest people are white. And this goes on for generation after generation. Like, there are like so many studies that have shown that, you know, Black families in this country were kept out of housing policies. Mm-hmm. And this has affected people from generation to generation. Yep. And so when you look at an article like this that's talking about passing on generational wealth, if you don't have it to begin with, you do stay on the bottom. And I think that's something that we have to look at as a country. As long as that graph remains like white people have the vast majority of the money, it means we're failing at something, because the country is not all that white anymore, and it shouldn't be like that.
Well, it is still majority white. So theoretically, if based on demographics,
those proportions are way off.
I'm not saying that they're not. I'm not saying that you know, look, I want to separate this comment from the concept of a legacy of negative policies that were made that have kept certain communities disadvantageous position. That is no doubt has happened, and we should continue to understand and figure out what the role of government should be in the lives of various people, because there are times in which, when wrongheaded, if not evil, policies are put in, then they can affect them far negatively. But I do also believe that in a majority white country, which I'm not saying should forever be, but it is right now, then it should not be a shock that those are the people who hold wealth proportionally.
I don't have the numbers, so I don't want to go and like make them up, but the number that
if you
saw
were going
graph,
to, what would it be?
Well, the thing, like, I want to say that it's like half, you know, we're around half of the country is white people. And that graph had like 80% of the wealth being for white. That's a huge
gap. And like the point that I'm trying to make is that white people were able to build generational wealth. That article was about how that generational wealth is now going to be passed on to the next generations within those families, and that we have policies in place that are facilitating that to happen. And I think that allows the elite and the upper middle class families to keep that wealth despite the kids not really doing anything to earn it. And because there is no wealth to pass on, even though you're right that like when you look at the lower, you know, percentile of people and how they're doing, like it is a flash in time. There is also, if you look at generational policies, you are keeping families in that lower bracket because they don't have anything to pass on. So I do think we have to look at that unfairness that started generations ago and look at the policies that we have now that are perpetuating these unfair outcomes, that people are not working for a living and walking into a life of privilege. And there are people who are working incredibly hard and just can't get above because they're working too many jobs without benefits. And like life is so hard and they have to spend all their extra money. Like that's what we need to be focusing on. And I think this generational wealth thing is a part of that conversation, or at least it should be.
I have a policy proposal.
Okay.
For rich kids. I'm taking Briney's law to Congress and I'm going to be a lobbyist for it. I'm going to pass it.
What's my law?
That there should be a work requirement for rich kids. I'm on board. I'm signed on a work requirement for rich kids. Or if you want to get out of it, you can pay your way out of it. Your parents can pay your way out of it like they've done for everything else by donating to patreon.com/we're not wrong. patreon.com/we're not wrong. A wealth transfer from the 1% to the artisans that craft fine podcasts for the world to enjoy. patreon.com/we're not wrong, because patrons of patreon.com/we're not wrong get a bonus topic each and every week. And we're going to be talking about quite a spicy pepper, that George Santos. Boy, howdy, does he keep getting himself in the news. Rung up on charges this week. The latest chapter of the Santos saga dissected for you, dear listener, and federally mandated rich kid donators, hopefully in the future, at patreon.com/we're not wrong. Let's talk about the Durham report. Over a period of 4 years, special counsel John Durham investigated the origins of the FBI's probe into potential connections between Russian officials and Donald Trump's 2016 presidential campaign. His report, long awaited, spans over 300 pages, and within it, Durham shows a wide-ranging examination extending beyond the primary question of whether individuals involved in initiating and executing the FBI's Trump-Russia probe should be prosecuted. The report explored the handling of the Trump-Russia allegations by the intelligence community, as well as the decision-making related to allegations of foreign interference efforts aimed at Hillary Clinton. Durham's goal was to assess whether Clinton-related and Trump-related allegations were being handled with equal rigor and aggressiveness. Durham noted that comparing the investigations isn't an imperfect method of assessing potential bias due to their different facts involved in various allegations, however. The FBI's response to the report indicated a change in leadership, with all senior executives who oversaw the original investigation no longer drawing a paycheck from the Bureau. The report ends with a powerful moment where FBI agents express a sense of betrayal upon learning the previously undisclosed intelligence that was not covered or factored into the Trump-Russia investigation. Intelligence that probably would have put a damper on the kind of effort and noise that it made. Now, the report does not propose any substantial changes to the FBI or Department of Justice policies, instead suggesting a return to faithfulness to existing rules. The report concludes with recommendations on how politically sensitive investigations should be handled differently in the future, such as assigning a career official to challenge FBI surveillance applications and avoid burying key details in footnotes. Briney, what should we take from this?
Man, I didn't expect this report to be as blunt as it was in regards to like this investigation never should have happened. But I read the executive summary, which, by the way, like, I know people heard that this report is 300 pages and no one wants to read that. But all you have to do is read the executive summary.
It's quick. It's very quick.
It was only a couple of pages and you really get like the down and dirty of like what happened. And essentially, like, they started the Russia investigation on pure bullshit and didn't even do like the bare minimum of due diligence to make sure the information that they were being handed was at all accurate. Because had they even asked the people involved in giving the information, those people themselves were like, oh, yeah, it was just rumors. Like, I have nothing to back that up. And those questions were not asked for years until, you know, after the investigation had already been going on and being reported endlessly on MSNBC. And so I think the American people for 2 years were, I don't want to say it was like a domestic psyop, but I don't know what the hell that was. But we were told that the president of the United States was a foreign agent, that there was all this evidence and this investigation happened. And I'm really disappointed with what happened at the FBI. And I also feel like something that a lot of us felt would happen was proven in regards to FISA warrants. Because these warrants for surveillance, they really became like just very popular. They were used all the time starting after the world war on terror. And a lot of us were really worried that these warrants would be handed out based on bullshit. That if someone within the government wanted to get one, that they just could. And that's what we saw happen here. That they're not only did they get the original warrant based on nothing, but then they got it renewed over and over again, even though they already had plenty of evidence that their original warrant was based on bad information. And so these so-called safeguards that we were told were put in to make sure that if something was discovered, the FISA warrant would be rescinded. We now have proof that that is not actually the case when people within the government want an investigation to continue. So I think we need to, and I think the Republicans being in charge of the House is actually a blessing in this regard. Because I think they're going to look at this report and possibly look at our surveillance laws and tighten them up, which we've needed. It's ironic because it was the Republicans that loosened them in the first place. But if it takes the next generation of Republicans to be the ones to tighten them back up, I'm all for it. And I just hope that happens because this was a really damning report on the Russia investigation, on the journalists that bought into it. It's a damning report on the FBI for sure. Their reputation is going to be very damaged from this. I don't care that the people involved in it have retired. I mean, this is a organizational thing. This went on for years. So, it was a really damning report. And I think that some good could come out of it if it leads to our surveillance laws being reined in.
Heaton?
Yeah, I think it was damning on multiple fronts. This was something that was quickly forgotten by Democrats.
A nothing burger.
That it was.
I heard it was one of the Mueller investigators on MSNBC discussing how much of a nothing burger it was.
The Durham report.
Yeah, really? somebody should apologize to Rachel Maddow. She spent so much time tracking the Russian oligarchs' yachts for nothing, as it turns out. Think of Maddow's time tracking the oligarch yachts.
I think we've rightly gone hard on the MAGA people that think the 2020 election was stolen and have caused all sorts of problems and how they've fallen sway to lunatic conspiracy theories that are destabilizing the country. For some reason, the narrative that Russians stole the 2016 election and it was an illegitimate election and that Donald Trump was a puppet who was not actually democratically elected by the American people because it was a rigged election, that has somehow just completely been mulliganed.
Putin's cock holster, as referred to by Stephen Colbert on late night television.
But actually, I want to go a step further because I don't want to. I'm less interested here in just kicking Democrats and Republicans. I hate them both. The parties of power, you listening at home, I love you, but the people in power, I hate them. The culprit here that I want to draw ire to is the FBI. I think the FBI is way too big and way too powerful. And I'm at the point where we should either abolish it or we should split it into about 8 different agencies because there's way, way, way too much power accumulated there. And when I talk to people about it, they're like, hold on. Now, the FBI made some mistakes, you know, in 2020 or 2016 and in the 90s and in the 80s And in the 70s.
And let's just forget when Hoover was alive. In the 60s, that we can write
that. That MLK thing didn't happen.
MLK into killing himself. And then, and then Hoover absolutely kept shit files on everybody so he could blackmail. Like, literally from day one, the FBI has been a political organization that has manipulated people politically. Hoover, the first director of the FBI, had files in his drawer. He would call up senators and he'd go, "Hey, it's Hoover with the FBI. We found in an unrelated investigation, we found that you've been sleeping with your intern. And we just wanted to know if you had any comment on that." And the guy'd go, "No, I just hope it doesn't get out to the press." And Hoover would go, "Okay, no problem. Just be aware." I mean, he would do that. He would call and let you know, "We've got shit on you. Do what I want," which is a very dangerous thing to do. What I think we ought to do is look at the FBI and go, what are the functions of the FBI that cannot be done by any other federal organization? And pin it down to that bit and then split it up into different agencies. I think the accumulation of power there is something that has continues to buck in politics, which is not supposed to happen with a politically neutral organization. We're not supposed to have an unelected Praetorian Guard. And I think we're, if we haven't already arrived at that point, we're rapidly getting to that. So I say split up the FBI into a bunch of different organizations.
Can I address one talking point that's come out of this? The idea that every article that is written about the Durham report, very high in the article, is there were three cases were brought criminally. Two of them could not secure convictions. One was the person who was brought was pled not guilty. So it's a 1 out of 3 thing. And that's being looked at, I think, and being talked about as a way to discredit the report. So shocker, the lawyer and the career FBI man who faced the criminal charges knew how to legally stay on the right side of the law while clearly doing things that were damaging to the country. I do not think that it is a point of pride for somebody to say that FBI agents and lawyers are able to stay on the right side of the law. They literally craft and adjudicate the law. Like, that is a thing that they do. I do not think that it is something that damns this. I do think that this is a great example of how a political machine can launder bullshit through a organism of our government, in this case, the FBI, but they worked hand and glove to get this thing, make this story credible and push it through the press that was obviously polarized politically and made a gigantic mountain out of what was essentially, we now know, a fucking fan fiction book report put together by a Russian national who, as pointed out in this Durham report, was already under investigation by the FBI for being a foreign national and peddling bullshit. He was under another investigation that was not brought up at all throughout this process. In fact, if I might offer a tribute to the fallen, BuzzFeed News, which is now no longer in existence over the last month, when CNN, and I remember this day very clearly, CNN came online with a breathless report. It was co-bylined by Jake Tapper, who it's very rich that he came out slamming the FBI as if he wasn't a gigantic part of pushing this narrative. And Carl Bernstein of Watergate. That's not by accident that they put both of them on the same byline to essentially rewrite elements of the Steele dossier. That's what they were reporting.
The piss tapes?
Yes. And BuzzFeed News, credit to them. And I don't mean this in any kind of side way. I do mean this honestly. Credit to them for running the entire Steele dossier immediately and not allowing other organizations to drip, drip, drip and make this thing seem like it was bigger than it was. They ran the entire thing. It looked and smelled like bullshit. Everybody in the political and media establishment were able to say, yeah, they've been trying to push this shit for 6 months and nobody really could confirm anything. We all tried. Nobody could find anything. It exposed CNN. And I just want to say one of the narratives that came out of 2016 and came out of Donald Trump, and we can understand Donald Trump to be a multifaceted element of American history. You could disagree with him politically. You could disagree with him for a million different reasons. But one of the things that came out of it was the idea of the death of shame, the death of, oh, well, you should be cowed. You should be resigning. You should be recusing yourself from X, Y, and Z. Guess what? He knew it was bullshit and he pushed back on it. And that turned out to be, based on everything that we have found out since, correct. And we need to understand that to be a fact as we go forward, including dealing with Donald Trump, including talking about his behavior on some of this stuff. Because at least in this case, this was total bullshit. And it was peddled specifically from Perkins Coie, the law firm for the DNC, which helped coordinate with various different journalists in the FBI. It was from FBI agents who were obviously politically motivated and for whatever reason thought they were saving the Republic by organizing. And I think it is not unkind of you to say, Jen, a domestic psyop on the American public. The fact that this went from, and here I remember another thing. I remember exactly where I was flying into the Democratic National Convention in Philadelphia, and I was going to cover it, and I was watching the Sunday shows, and Robbie Mook, the head of the Clinton campaign, in response to the WikiLeaks or the email hack leaks from their servers, said, well, we believe the Russians did it. And that was the first time that I was like, oh, Jesus, really? The Russians? We're going to go with the Russians on this? Good luck, buddy. Guess what? They did. And it took 2 years of our attention, 2 years of our time, 2 years of rage that could have been directed to Donald Trump for a million other things. It's not like he was not bold or shy about other stuff for which ire could actually be directed that has something to do with policy, that has something to do with our country, not just out and out fan fiction. So I'm glad this is out. I do not find the fact that two of the three cases that were brought, you couldn't find legal culpability among the people that will avoid legal culpability the most in the world are lawyers and FBI agents. It would have been the dead girl or alive boy situation for them to be gone. So there we go. That's my rant.
I didn't know that's how it was being covered because I only read the report itself. I always do that before I talk about something.
Yeah.
But I looked at it as an inspector general's report this is what happened. Like I saw that part where they talked about, you know, this is how many convictions we got. That was a side note to me. I never would have even brought it up. I'm shocked that that's something that you're seeing.
That is in like the second paragraph of every news story on this is pointing out. Yeah. It's almost as if you're trying to knock it down because either from the journalist side, yes, look at me. I'm criticizing journalism. It's because they're ashamed. Because they're ashamed that they followed it. Because they're ashamed
because
that
they were conspiracy peddlers that were saying that an election was illegitimate for several years.
It was Newsmax. You were. In fact, I don't watch Newsmax, so I don't even want to slander Newsmax. You were a message board. You were QAnon. It was absolutely not grounded in fact. And instead of trying to look into it yourself and find corroborating evidence, which is where this started, by the way. It wasn't until it became this larger story that everybody started marching along. There's another larger conversation about journalism when it comes to unnamed sources. I think that this was another part of the reason why this was allowed to march on is because especially in political journalism, especially through the Trump era, we became a lot more tolerant of multiple unnamed sources, and I'm putting air quotes up for that because that can often mean one person who told two other people to call the same journalist. There is no accountability there. Those should always be looked at with tremendous suspicion. And the fact that we pushed them so hard because the idea of this story was so juicy and so big hurt the country. It was bad for America.
My favorite headline from that entire period was from Clickhole, and it said, "Bad news, Hillary fans, : the piss tapes are real, but they're hot as hell."
I mean, and that never made sense. He's a germaphobe.
Right.
Yeah.
Okay, so the thing that also pisses me off about this is I don't like that I've been nudged into the whole deep state space. That used to be something I kind of scoffed at, and now I'm like, oh, no, it turns out when you fuck with the security apparatus fucks with you. That is a thing. And that was something that I was fairly dismissive of 2 years ago, of like, I invited Ron Paul on my program to talk about foreign policy because he's been a lifelong non-interventionist. And within about 10 minutes, he said something about the deep state. And I went, by deep state, Dr. Paul, you mean the unelected bureaucracy, right? You just mean people that are difficult to fire in the civil service? And he goes, no, you know, like the CIA and the FBI, the people that killed Kennedy. And I was like, what? And we had a 5-minute conversation about how the CIA and FBI killed Kennedy. I don't think they did, but I've gone from like 99% sure that they didn't kill Kennedy to like 95% sure that they didn't kill Kennedy. So the needle is moving.
Yeah.
And the idea that there's
one.
There's,
huh? Which one?
Gosh, I guess.
Which Kennedy? Jack or Bobby? Both.
The kid. I think they set up the plane years later.
Or Junior. Yeah.
Yeah. But there is like, to go back to this whole Praetorian Guard thing, there is some vested interests in maintaining the status quo and maintaining the military industrial complex and maintaining the security state. And when candidates come in that buck that, apparently the FBI's okay with trying to knock them out of the way, which is a very disturbing thing. In the same way that we should be disturbed when Donald Trump proposes extrajudicial solutions to problems, when Donald Trump floats the idea of suspending the Constitution in order to put him back at the presidency, which he did on Twitter or whatever it was. Truth Social 4 months ago.
Very good. Growing all of those, fast.
All those things where we go, man, that guy really doesn't believe in the system and he's a threat to liberal democratic order. I'm going to say that the security state and the FBI are playing that same game and they're also a problem and they're also a danger.
Agreed.
We need to also understand what this did to comedy. The Russia shit ruined comedy for 2 full years. 2 full years. Comedy sucked so terribly. Not to say that it would have been
good. I would
argue
a lot longer than that. Yeah. I think that like Trump was horrible for the comedy years.
But just also, but the Russia stuff is so hack. It's like, it just literally, just all this recycled bullshit from the 80s. Like, vomit.
I tried so hard to get Yakov Smirnoff into a Reason sketch video about 2 months ago. It was going to be completely unrelated to him. And I was going to have Yakov Smirnoff in a rowboat just go, did you tell him about the shoe metaphor? And then the guy was going to go, shut the fuck up, Yakov Smirnoff, for no reason. I tried so hard. I bet he had a field
day. You hear him? Did you hear back from him?
We're still working on that sketch. I suspect we're not going to do it, but it'd be really funny.
All right. We'renotwrongpod@gmail.com. We'renotwrongpod@gmail.com. Write it in your email program and then write other stuff below it. We'renotwrongpod@gmail.com. WNW Drinking Game writes, take a shot if 1, Justin defends journalists, 2, Andrew mentions Scotland or Edinburgh, or 3, Jen curses. Finish your drink when Andrew says, demonstrable. Jen and Andrew argue over something they agree on without realizing it until 15 minutes later. Or Justin doubles down on defending journalists despite obviously being wrong.
Oh boy, people gonna die.
Okay, today you attack journalists. So does everybody have to vomit their drink up?
Everybody spits.
Everybody spit your drink out. Justin, everybody attack journalists.
I attack.
Like they do in Scotland. It's demonstrable. Drink up, bitches.
Jen, do you want to curse?
No, I didn't realize I do it that much that it needs to be a drinking game. So maybe I should cool it with my.
It's only a shot, though. It's only a shot. So they're expecting you to do it multiple times.
It's crazy that they said shots. Like, this is going to kill people.
I'm more bothered by the fact that I apparently say demonstrable as much as Jen curses. That is disturbing to me from a public speaking standpoint.
Do I really curse more than you guys?
You curse about as much as I say demonstrable, apparently. I need to retire that word for a couple of months. Throw people off.
Well, I mean,
it's self-evident that.
Yeah, there we go. Okay. A Precious Soul writes, regarding the conversation of ever-increasing national debt, have any of you all heard of modern monetary theory, Heaton?
Yeah, I have heard of modern monetary theory.
Jen just threw her mic on the ground and hung her head in exasperation.
Yeah, okay. So there's two different forms of modern monetary theory. There's the economic theory that I can talk about in a second, which I think has some interesting points to it. And then there's how I find it used, which is the same sorts of people that think we should allocate resources based on interpretive dance will invoke modern monetary theory as a way of saying, see, there is no consequence to government spending ever. We can just spend forever. The debt doesn't matter. The deficit doesn't matter now or ever.
Money is fake.
Money's fake. We should be able to spend as much as we want on whatever we want. There is no reality undergirding money. Which, by the way, I don't think that's what people that actually purport modern monetary theory would say either. If you want to do like a really quick overview of kind of the different approaches to the debt and deficit that are floating around right now, there's the kind of old school tighten the belt approach, which is that deficits are bad, surpluses are good, and the debt is evil. That is what Republicans are rhetorically committed to and do absolutely nothing to militate against when they're actually in power. There's another model that kind of starts with Alexander Hamilton, and that's the idea that debts and deficits aren't inherently bad. They're just tools, and what you really need to worry about is whether the debt is growing faster than the economy. If the economy is growing faster than the debt, doesn't really matter. In the same way that if I'm increasing my debt every month by $10, but I'm increasing my income every month by an additional $10,000, my income's growing so much faster than the debt that it doesn't matter, right? I fall into that camp. I actually think that the debt and the deficit don't matter that much so long as the debt is growing slower in proportion to the overall economy. Modern monetary theory makes the two claims, as I understand it. One, that there can be no default on the debt because a sovereign country can print its own money. Therefore, if we ever have too many IOUs, we just print more money to pay them out. Yes, that's absolutely true. No one was ever disagreeing with that premise. You can absolutely print your way out of debt. It's called inflation, or hyperinflation is what we would probably deal with. Modern monetary people will generally respond to that by saying, well, hold on, we proponents of MMT are very big on making sure that inflation doesn't get rampant. Before it did that, we would increase taxes. Okay, well, now we're back into the realm of normal economics, which is that at some point you have to pay through stuff through either taxes or through inflation. And we're back to where we were. I think modern monetary people would say that I am being too stingy by saying that the debt to GDP ratio is what actually matters. And they would say that the interest payments to GDP is what actually matters. That might be the case, in which case there would be more wiggle room, but it wouldn't change any of the fundamentals that we're talking about. At some point, the debt becomes so large that the people that were soliciting for credit to pay back the prior debt don't think they can get their money back. And at that point, we either have to jack up interest rates, or we default, or we do hyperinflation. And so please take away from this that modern monetary theory is not a magical card you can slam on the table that goes deficits and debts never matter ever because MMT.
Thank you for attending Heaton's TED Talk. Jen, have you ever heard of modern monetary theory?
Of course. The people that love it, these Stephanie Kelton lovers, they will fill up your inbox and tell you exactly what Heaton just said, that like deficits don't matter, debt doesn't matter. You can like, I can't. So do I understand it in the way that Heaton has...
The interpretive dance economist?
Yeah, I mean, Andrew, you have clearly taken far more time than I have to try to engage with this. I'm not going to bother. I don't care about it. Oh God, the emails are coming. I should have just shut up. They're coming.
All right.
Yes, I've heard of it. I've heard of it. Stop emailing us about it.
I want to thank this emailer because it's clear that either they are new to this show and they have found this show and they're not aware of what we have done in the past, for which that's amazing, right? That's great. Yeah. Or they came from one of our various different things, but certainly don't know Heaton, because Heaton has almost assuredly talked about modern monetary theory probably more than most people that I know. So there we go. I wish you would have talked about the bill, writes. From what I've read, the main part of the Republican spending, or the Republican bill about the debt ceiling, sets a framework for establishing funding levels back to 2022 and then limits future growth to 1%. My understanding of government funding is that there is a baseline to which some increase is given each year. Resetting the funding baseline to 2022 seems better than using the much higher baseline set recently. It seems that the Republican bill has set a framework for which Congress can operate to decide what and how much to fund. While I don't think this is how we should deal with the debt ceiling, to my mind, this is something that should be done. So they wish that we would have talked more about the bill itself.
Well, okay, this is where someone's going to say that I'm bitchy, but too bad. The thing is that this is how they are dealing with the debt ceiling. You can like what the Republicans are trying to do with the budget. You can discuss those as policies when it's time to talk about the budget. We are talking about the debt ceiling right now. They are two completely different topics, and this is not how you do it.
The Republicans have not put forth an official budget. They are behind in their appropriations process. If they actually cared about the budget, they'd be working on that instead of threatening the faith and credit in the United States being able to pay its bills. So like, no, hard no, I'm not going to give this any attention on the substance, because that's what they want. What they want is for us to be like, but these proposals are reasonable. Not like this. They're not. So until it is time to talk about the budget, I'm not looking at their proposals. I'm not engaging with their proposals. The debt ceiling needs to be raised, and then we can get to the budget. But they do not deserve that conversation.
You want to know who might disagree with you, Jen?
A lot of people.
Joseph Robinette Biden Jr., who they are currently in their negotiations. However, and I only point to this specifically because there's a bit of an Orwellian difference when McCarthy and the Republicans walk into the room to negotiate. They will tell the reporters on the way in, we are here to talk about the debt ceiling. When Biden and his team walks in, they are very specifically talking about the budget. And that is the hole in the sheet for which gets both teams in the room to talk about it. So according to Biden, they are talking about the budget, and they are exclusively talking about the budget. They are not talking about the debt ceiling because they want to make a deal that has the debt ceiling effectively not matter. Or at least that is their point right now. Who knows what happens?
But I think that just kind of backs up what I said, doesn't it? That like they're two separate issues. Like there do need to be budget negotiations.
Yeah, I think well, you're right about that.
Except for the fact that they're having the same conversation. Well, like they're calling it two different things, but they are having like the deal they are making. One will walk out of the room, should they make a deal, one will walk out of the room and say, we beat them on the debt ceiling. And the other will walk out of the room and say, we made a deal on the budget. All of this is the exact same thing. It's just how you talk about it.
But Jen's right. The budget and the debt ceiling are different. Like I liked the idea of the debt ceiling 2 months ago before I looked into it, because the idea behind it was we're going to force Congress to think about its spending every 2 years. And then you look at the track record and it's like, oh, that doesn't seem to have much effect on suppressing the debt or profligate spending in any way. What it really does is just open us up to brinksmanship towards defaulting every 2 years, which would make everything far more expensive moving forward. So it doesn't serve any big purpose. The Republican proposal to cap spending at 2022 levels is a good one. The proposals to try to get the debt and the deficit reined in involve some amount of spending caps at a particular place. And in my opinion, some amount of tax increases and spending cuts. So like capping it at 2022, great. But as Jen points out, that is a budget proposal. I'd say the deficit ceiling is just something that is just causing problems for us at this point. It's not solving anything. We ought to get rid of it.
My Tinder bio writes, government is the society's repository for coercive power, relinquished from the members so that the entirety of society doesn't become vigilante justice and survival of the fittest robber barons.
I feel your pain, Tinder person. I feel your pain.
Unclog your ears, you tweed dingus, writes, I'm going to present Jen's question to Andrew Heaton once again, since he seems to have never actually answered it. You are the president of the United States. The debt ceiling has arrived. You are left with two options: default on the debt or ignore the debt ceiling. We all know both of those options have disastrous outcomes, but there is no third option. You will pick between the two.
No. I could be wrong. This, Jen, didn't you say that this would really only buy us time till March? Is that correct? Even if he were to
in the Republicans the Republicans proposal, the bill that they passed, it would go until March. Yes.
No, I'm just giving you a flat out no. My reasoning behind that is I don't want to go into default. I think it would make everything much more expensive. Interest payments would rise. That would increase the debt. It would squeeze out spending going into capital.
You're not picking between the two.
I wouldn't do it. Because
you're going to be a coward and not pick between the two.
I'm going
to be a big
say
old chicken.
No,
this
I'm
person
not.
This person is.
I think I just
clear.
Gave you my answer, Justin. No, said, I'm not going to do that. We'll go into default. Yes.
Oh, you are going to default.
Yes.
Oh, I thought you were saying no, as in you were saying no to the question.
No, Biden am not going to enact that new thing. And
you're not going to enact the 14th Amendment.
No, I'm not going to do that.
Okay. And ignore
defaulting
the debt
would be horrible. I don't want to do that. We should get rid of the deficit ceiling. But no, I'm not going to do that for this reason. You're not solving the problem. You're just buying a few months. It's going to get shot down by the courts anyway, at which point we're exactly back where we were, plus a constitution. constitutional problem. So all you're doing is buying 8 months and a constitutional crisis. That you're not actually fixing or solving anything. You're just kicking the can down the road in a panic with potentially permanent changes to the nature of the presidency and an abrogation of the Constitution. While it's a very, you've given me a Kobayashi Maru, but that is not a the lesser of two evils in that instance is no.
Is default. There we go. 14th Amendment Fan Club writes, should somebody go down the path of using the clause that the debt shall not be questioned, it has two hurdles to overcome. Number one, original intent. The obvious intent was to distinguish Union debt from Confederate Civil War debt. The USA refused to pay debt incurred by the Confederates or its states, but needed to reinsure its lenders that this did not apply to debts issued by the Union. And B, interpretation of words. Should somebody want to take the words debt shall not be questioned more broadly, then the fair interpretation that is that nothing shall prevent repayment of debt, not Lawrence Tribe's overreach that executives can continue to borrow without constraint. The best contextual interpretation would be that those words empower, nay, require the executive to prioritize debt payments over all other federal expenditures. If you use the phrase accurately, nay, in your email, I will read it on this show. Adman writes, whenever you mention Nielsen ratings, I always think about this. I work in the advertising technology space. And what we know from the agencies that we work with is that Nielsen ratings have long been suspected to be total bullshit. That suspicion was confirmed in the wake of COVID, when TV viewing patterns changed dramatically in very specific ways. But yet the Nielsen data told a different story. In fact, 2 years ago, Nielsen lost its accreditation with the Media Rating Council as a trusted rating source. Despite this, News Corp and others decided to continue to cite Nielsen ratings as gospel throughout the pandemic. Nielsen has been scrambling to cover their ass ever since, and other competitors have entered the space, which has been very, very interesting to see. Nielsen just got its accreditation back recently, but their credibility among many ad agencies and TV networks may never recover. So I thought that was interesting from inside that space. I was not aware.
See, I knew they were garbage. I didn't know any details or facts or anything, but I just knew.
There we go. Somewhere between pundit's intuition and a bank error in your favor, you get full points for this one, Friday.
I think yes. Cable television news is probably going to collapse within the next 10 years. And this is yet another example of that. The profit model based on advertising appears to be faulty at the bottom in terms of the sensors used to get that advertising. So one more reason that this is not going to be a house of cards that stands up forever.
Well, yeah, I mean, and in the rest of this email that I did not read, he points out that a new player in this space are actually television manufacturers, Vizio and Roku. Vizio actually got in trouble for this, but they have technology that records what you are watching and reports it back to their servers on by default on your television. And if you don't go turn it off, they just get it, which means they have by far a way bigger sample, a more representative sample size of America than Nielsen, which I believe this emailer points out has like a 0.25 or 0.5% representation of America based on their technology, which is not exactly a gigantic or expansive. So
great. Let the data flow. Thanks, Roku.
The only man left thinking in this country brings us on home. The next World War II vet that dies, we should find a $1 trillion Nazi coin in his house. Germany won't want it back because, you know, Nazis. It already exists, so it's non-inflationary. It'd be irresponsible not to use Nazi money to fund the greatest beacon of freedom in the world. And we could also charge admission to see it and pay it back, so it's net positive.
All the world's problems have now been solved.
Sure. Thank you for your, you need to come up with a real good name for that theory that doesn't involve saying the Nazi solution or something like
exactly.
that.
Exactly. Everybody keeps talking about printing of $1 trillion coin. Why don't we find a $1 trillion Nazi coin? We can introduce it in the new Indiana Jones. It'll be perfect. We're Not Wrong is a production of Dog and Pony Show Audio. Our editor is Will Saddleberg. Jen, what's up with the dish, congressional dish?
So I did release an episode, came back from vacation, and I released an episode. It was an interview, a very rare congressional dish interview with Maya Kornberg. Yeah, she wrote a whole book about congressional committees and answered some questions that I've been wondering about for a long time about how they work, and had some really good suggestions for how they can get better, gave us some hope for, you know, there's processes happening right now and which might be helping our committee. So yeah, it was a really interesting interview that I intended to just be for patrons, but I thought it was good enough for the public. So that is on Congressional Dish right now.
You should put more of those on your feed.
Absolutely. Check that out. That sounds awesome, Jen. I'm going to listen to that for sure.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
Hmm. All right.
I would, that's a fundamental element of how Congress works, understanding how committees work. That sounds great.
And it doesn't involve you killing yourself with 19 hours of research, which I am for Jen Briney sustainability. So if you can knock out an episode in an hour and a half and not 25 hours, mix those in every once in a while. Okay. Heaton.
Thank you, Justin.
The Political Orphanage.
I've got a great show this week. I want to pose a question. Either of you or both of you can answer this. Was Abraham Lincoln left wing or right wing? Where would you put him on the political spectrum? Jen?
I wouldn't. I don't know enough.
Well, you know what? I'm going to say you're right, because the political spectrum didn't exist when Abraham Lincoln was around, or any of the founding fathers. And so I talked to a guy that wrote a book on how trying to project there's an essence to conservatism that explains everything in the Republican Party, and there's an essence to progressivism that explains everything in the Democratic Party is just astrology. It's a grab bag of unrelated stuff. There are certain things that have a philosophy to them, but there's no essence to conservatism or progressivism. If you disagree with me and you're about to write me an angry email, listen to the goddamn show.
Yeah.
But for people that were already on board with that already thought, and I think my listeners are probably already on board with the idea that the left-right spectrum is bullshit. What I found fascinating about that is when it actually hits American politics, because you will find no reference to left-right thinking in Jefferson, Washington, Hamilton, Abraham Lincoln, Calvin Coolidge. It's real late in the game when we actually start trying to reduce the American political experience to a binary that we can kind of cut up into a ruler. That's on The Political Orphanage.
Look at that. And we might finally have a fight here in this Republican primary. We saw for the first time in months a weekend in which Ron DeSantis looked competent and Donald Trump looked incompetent. I extrapolate exactly what happened and what the very, very close at hand debut of Ron DeSantis 2024 will herald on the Politics, Politics, Politics program, available now in all of your podcatchers. But for patrons, you're going to hear about George Santos right after this. For everybody else, well, that's it. Till next time, I'm Justin Robert Young. For Andrew Heaton and Jen Briney, we're not wrong.
Dog and Pony Show Audio.